Turn with me to the Gospel of Mark, chapter 15. Tremendous passage as we consider what God is doing with this whole passion of Jesus, the suffering of Jesus. There's so much about it. And it's not just meant to try to evoke some sympathy or some sentiment toward the sufferings of Jesus. There's something much deeper to this, particularly as we see right now the religious leaders have had to make a decision. What are they going to do with Jesus? Now they're going to bring it before Pilate, the governor. He's going to have to make a decision. What shall I do with Jesus? The people are going to have to make a decision. The soldiers make decisions. Every one of us, even today, contemporarily, we will make a decision on what we will do with Jesus. And I think the very fact the question is still in front of us is a very important point that God has. And one day, every knee will bow and every tongue will confess He is Lord. But now we are in the valley of decision. What will we do with this Jesus who is called the Christ? Let's jump in and see, because in many ways what you have here is a great model and example of what I would call Pilate trying a number of ways to squirm out from that decision. And there's a lot of application in our own lives for this, because the political maneuvering has been amazing. What do we do with Jesus? Immediately, verse 1 of chapter 15, immediately in the morning the chief priests held a consultation with the elders and the scribes and the whole council. And they bound Jesus, led him away, and delivered him to Pilate. Now, the rulers have already made their decision. We saw last time that they had already decided he was worthy of death because of the charge, blasphemy. This morning consultation was just a formality to make it legal, the illegal trial of the previous night. They've already basically beaten him, spit on him, mocked on him, struck him with the palms of their hands. They have treated him disparagingly because they've already made their mind up. And no doubt, they would have loved to do him in right then. What prevents them? Well, there was this thing called Roman law. They didn't have the right to capital punishment. But folks, that didn't stop them with Stephen. Later on, when they didn't like what Stephen had to say, they stoned him on the spot. I believe they could have easily done that with Jesus too and gotten away with it. But I think that the problem is more political. They knew there'd be a backlash. So they need to dress this thing up a little bit and make the Romans do it. You see, by making this a criminal case before Rome, they're hoping this Jesus movement will disappear. That instead of Jesus being a martyr, if they stone him, like one of the prophets, they think, well, if Rome crucifies him, if Rome treats him as a criminal, there's no way that people will follow him as Messiah. So they essentially have convened to formally go through this, now to dress it up, and now they're bringing him to Pilate. Now, when they come to Pilate, interestingly enough, they don't even want to go in the praetorium, John tells us, because their feet will be defiled for Passover. They want to keep themselves ceremonially pure. And I think what hypocrisy to be so mindful of some religious scruple, and yet at the same time, there's no mercy, no sensitivity to the things of God at all. You might know people like that. They're very in tune to the scruples of their religion, but they're frustrated and angry and impatient and bitter. And you wonder, what's wrong with this picture? And here they are, their twisted minds, you know, their hearts on fire by hell itself to destroy the Son of God, yet in tune to these minute details of their religion. Pilate had to actually go out to meet them. Now, Pilate, interesting guy. He ruled as a Roman governor from AD 26 to 36, only 10 years. It's about all he could handle, and it's about all he lasted. The Bible does not go into details a lot about him, but historians, Philo and Josephus, tell us he was a cruel man. There were certain things that he did that he was already in trouble with his political appointment, being there the governor, because his whole job, listen, Tiberius Caesar, all they cared about was the Roman peace. Keep the peace. Keep people happy. You can rip them off with taxes. You can get away with whatever. Just keep the peace. That's all that matters. Well, Pilate had a hard time. He didn't understand the Jews, and they were particularly difficult. He made some serious errors already. When he first came into Jerusalem, he brought these big, huge pole standards with the flags, and the images on the flags were totally against the religion of the Jewish people, to have any graven image. And the Jewish people just immediately protested, and they went out in the open square, and they tried to stop the standards. Well, Pilate, I mean, he's a governor. He's not going to listen to these people. He brings the soldiers in, take their heads off, cut, just, you know, and he figures this will scare them and scatter the crowd, threatening death. Instead, these Jewish people, these men, stood their ground, laid their necks bare on the ground, lied down and says, go ahead, kill us, but we're not letting you bring those standards in. How do you rule such people? Pilate's wondering. I mean, these people are radical. So he lost the first skirmish, had to back off. Then he did a raid on the temple treasury to pay for an aqueduct. And then, of course, he did one more huge mistake. The Galileans were in the temple, and he came against them, and they actually killed them in the temple. So their blood was mingled with the sacrifices. He's made a number of mistakes. A huge report has already came to Rome about him. One more complaint, he might lose his position. So, in a sense, they figure they have him right where they want him. They figure they can manipulate him, get him to do what they want. Blackmail is what it really is. They figure, you know, you'll do what we want or else. So they basically come and bring Jesus there. And why did you bring him, Pilate says. And the other gospel account says in John, well, if he weren't an evildoer, we wouldn't have brought him to you. In other words, they don't even want to tell him. Pilate says, then you judge him if he's some malicious person in your religion. And they said, no, we can't kill him according to the law. You have to do it. So Pilate's in this uncomfortable position of what he has to do. And he needs to appease them, but he also does have a sense of Roman justice. He's afraid of his job, but he doesn't want to just like do what they want because they want him to do it. He wants to know what's the basis. He's in a tough spot. So he's faced with what to do with Jesus. Four times, distinct attempts of Pilate to squirm out of crucifying Jesus. Four different times he tries some other thing, and each time it keeps coming back and forces him into a decision of eventually turning Jesus over to be crucified. But I like looking at these dilemmas. There's a lot of human interest story here. There's a lot of interesting things in our own lives. We'd wonder, what would I do with Jesus if I were in that situation? But more than that, literally, you are there. You are going to be faced with challenges. That it won't be popular to be a follower of Jesus in this culture. What are you going to do with your discipleship? You're saying, I believe in Jesus. Because right now, listen, there are, according to Barna Research, two-thirds of Americans are what he would group them in a casual Christian label. Casual Christians. That is, they're Christians in name only. They're not really disciples. About 1/6 of the population of America would be considered disciples of Jesus, followers of Jesus. But there's a whole bunch of them in this one group that just are called casual Christians. They're Christians in name only. And the reason it's popular to even go that, because, you know, we've basically reduced it down to it really doesn't mean anything. I'm not going to talk about Jesus in public. I'm not going to, you know, live my life according to his ways. I'm not going to really submit to him when I don't feel like it. You know, I'm just, you know, he's cool with me. Jesus is just all right with me, like the Doobie Brothers sang, you know. That's about the commitment level. And this is where it really does test where you are. And I think with Pilate, we see. So verse 2, it says, Pilate asked him, are you the king of the Jews? Mark just jumps right into it. Why would he just jump right into that question is because, you see, they can't charge him before Pilate with blasphemy, so they make up this trumped-up charge and calling him like he's a traitor. He wants to be king. And so Pilate pulls him aside privately, according to John, and says, are you the king of the Jews? And he answered and said to him, it is as you say. Other accounts say, you said it. Like Jesus says, you've said it. The implication in the Greek language is very clear. He is saying, yes, I am a king, but with a provision. John tells us what the provision was. John tells us that when Pilate asked him, you know, your own nation delivered you up, Are you the king of the Jews? And Jesus says, do you say this thing of yourself, or did others tell it to you? And Pilate says, your own people delivered you up. And Jesus said, well, my kingdom is not of this world. So in a say, he's saying, yes, I am king, but it's not what you think. My kingdom is not of this world. If my kingdom were of this world, my servants would fight, that I would not be delivered over to the Jews. But now my kingdom is not from here. And Pilate says, are you a king then? And Jesus said, you said it. To this end I was born. For this cause I came into the world, that I might bear witness to the truth. This is the reason why Jesus came into the world, you know. He says it in John chapter 18, verse 37, that I might bear witness to the truth. And then he says this, everyone who is of the truth hears my voice. What Jesus does by this is actually turns the tables on Pilate. He essentially reveals to Pilate and to everyone watching and to all of us today, it is not Jesus that's on trial here, folks. It's us. It's Pilate. It's the leaders. It's the people. What will you do with Jesus? Jesus tells you what you'll do. If you're of the truth, you'll hear my voice. If you're not of the truth, you won't. This is the dividing line. Now, it's very humbling to consider. It comes right down to this. But where does this put you? You see, this is the difficulty. Pilate, dealing with the situation, doesn't want to just roll over and become executioner. He wants to find the accusation. Then he takes him privately, are you the king? And of course, Jesus explains. And then they come on even more. Notice it says the chief priests accused him of many things, but he answered nothing. And Pilate asked him again, saying, do you answer nothing? See how many things they testify against you? Jesus still answered nothing, so that Pilate marveled. You know, Pilate is in this difficult position, but he's watching Jesus and he's amazed at this guy. This is not your average, ordinary traitor or insurrectionist, rebel from the Jews. This guy's different. You know, it's interesting how they try to make him seem like he was a rabble-rouser, he was stirring up the crowds. Luke tells us that he was accused of perverting the nation's teaching, spreading teaching throughout Judea, forbidding people to pay taxes, which was a lie. Remember, he said, render to Caesar the things that are Caesar's. That he said he was a king, and they twisted his words. And, you know, it's interesting. The world wants you to think, just like they want Pilate to think, that he's a threat politically. There is a strategy to malign what true Christianity is, to make it seem like a political threat. Now, I suppose in some ways, if your heart is truly influenced by God and the Bible, you are going to vote a certain way. You're going to live a certain way. And I guess that would be a political threat to those that are corrupt, don't want anything to do with morality. You might influence others to live the Christian life. And listen, during times of revival, what's defined this nation has really been from times of revival. Most people don't realize that in the 1790s, the moral condition of this country was far worse than it is today. Even with all of the internet junk and all of the corruption, it was worse then. You couldn't even find anyone who wanted to publicly profess faith in Christ. It was taking your life into your hands with the mob. They'd do you in. Christians that were at Harvard University would actually write in code because they were afraid of being caught. They'd write their minutes in code because they were afraid. You couldn't find a Christian in certain universities. In Dartmouth, they were conducting anti-Christian plays. It was the peak of the Renaissance, and it was not popular at all to be a believer. What happened? How did we become so religious then as a nation? Because a revival hit, huge revival, the Great Awakening in America, which formed a whole transformation of this nation, and they got back to the Bible, which they had pretty much in a few decades had discarded. We're at a place where we think it's so bad, but folks, it's been worse. And if revival comes again, we'll have more time. But if not, who knows what we'll become as a nation. The end of the day is, the world wants to make you think that you're a threat politically. They'll label you the Christian right. Now there's a whole new movement. Well, gee, I'm going to be a popular Christian on the left. And that's very popular, of course, these days. But whether left or right, what are you? Are you a follower of Jesus or not? Do you believe in the truth? So Jesus, of course, was silent before these accusations, and it's almost the silence of innocence. You know, lies are like a fish out of water. They eventually flap themselves to death. Jesus doesn't see any need to defend himself. His character, his nature, his history stands for itself. All the other stuff is just baseless accusations. And you know what? Listen, mudslinging is a powerful political tool. And it's also been used to split churches and undermine groups of people and social organizations because of rumors and innuendos and the mudslinging. Because essentially they figure if they throw enough mud, some of it will stick. And certainly lies happen. You know, people, if you believe a lie about somebody, it's, well, you've formed an opinion. So the mud, they keep throwing the mud in political battles, hoping that some of it will stick. But you know, with Jesus, it might have stuck in the minds of people about him, but it never stained who he was. His very presence, his prior ministry, stood his ground. He was holy, undefiled, and harmless. And Pilate, he's a shrewd guy. He can see it. And I think the Lord even appeals to the very heart of Pilate by saying, "Everyone who is of the truth hears my voice." Now, he's trying to reach him. Of course, Pilate just sneers, "What is truth?" And frankly, that's probably the biggest challenge today for a lot of young people, whether there is even an absolute truth to begin with. To the postmodern generation, which we see now in front of us, the gospel is just what they would call a meta-narrative. And in other words, it's like it's a bunch of stories to try to paint this big story, because we need a story. And they'll say that we all want a story to piece everything together and live happily ever after. And so the gospel is just this big meta-narrative. But what they'll try to convince you in college is there are no meta-narratives. There are no bigger stories. There's a lot of little stories that you make for yourself. Make your own little story. You can become your own God. You can become, believe in yourself. Write your own narrative. There is no big story. There is no meta-narrative. Listen, all those who hold themselves critical of Jesus really are the ones on trial. But the more you honestly seek for truth, you'll have sufficient evidence to believe in Jesus. Pilate, however, makes the big mistake, and unfortunately this is where a lot of people are today. He now turns to the crowd. In the second solution, Mark doesn't cover, we won't even cover it as well, but Luke tells us that he saw a way out of this by sending Jesus to Herod, since Jesus was a Galilean, and Herod's jurisdiction was Galilee, so hey, well, that's one way to deal with him. I won't make the decision, I'll let Herod make it. Unfortunately, when Jesus went to Herod, remember Herod, according to Luke, Herod was very excited to see Jesus. He's thinking, all right, I get to see a miracle. This will be cool. He always wanted to see Jesus. He heard all these stories. And that's all he cared about. Only one problem. Jesus had nothing to say to Herod. And do you know why? Because Herod had already silenced God's voice by killing John the Baptist. And God had nothing more to say to him. Now, it's a sad day when your heart become so hardened that God will no longer speak to your conscience. You basically have hardened, you've killed the voice of God in your life. Now, at what point that happens, only God is the judge of that. No one can be the judge. I've seen some people I thought, yeah, they were 10 times farther removed from having any conscience at all, and yet God has rescued them. So, you never know. Only God knows. But God had nothing to say, and so Herod sent him back to Pilate. Now he has to deal with it. Now stage three, the third possible way to squirm out, is he's hoping to appeal to the crowd. You see, the crowd, he knows something about Jesus. Jesus has been pretty popular. He had quite a following. He knew what was going on the week before, all the people singing Hosanna to the Son of David. You know, I mean, I'm sure he was aware of these things, but he's thinking, you know what, these rulers, well, let's read this section, verse 6 through 10. He says, "At the feast he was accustomed to releasing one prisoner to them, whomever they requested. And there was one by the name of Barabbas, who was chained with his fellow rebels, and they had committed murder in the rebellion. He was a patriot of the Jews. He was one standing strong against Rome. He had committed murder in that insurrection. But he would have been considered a very popular patriot. Well, the multitude was crying aloud, beginning to ask him to do just as he had always done for them. That is, the custom of releasing a prisoner. Pilate's thinking, I can turn this to my advantage. Get out from dealing with this Jesus directly. I'll let the crowd decide. So he says, do you want me to release to you the King of the Jews? And he tells us why he put it to the crowd. Verse 10. For he knew that the chief priests had handed him over because of envy. So he's thinking, okay, I get it. These leaders are envious of Jesus. He's so popular, that's why they hate him. So if I turn it over to the crowd, Jesus or Barabbas? The one who you call the King of the Jews or this Barabbas, which means son of the Father? It's an irony there. You've got the son of the real Father here and then the counterfeit son of the Father. And you know, wouldn't you know it? Shocking as it is to Pilate, they called for Barabbas. He underestimated the cleverness of the Pharisees. Because in verse 11 it says, the chief priests stirred up the crowd so that he should rather release Barabbas to them. Now, how do you think they pulled that one off? These people were excited about the Messiah, the son of David, they called him. That this is it, save now, Hosanna. How is it possible they could go from that to crucify him? Well, if I'm a Pharisee, I got to really think this one through. This is my opinion. I don't know if this is how they did it. Doesn't say. But I suspect that just like their father, the devil, Jesus, remember, he told them, you know, you are of your father, the devil, who was a liar from the beginning. They were able to succeed in deceiving these people. And it would have worked like this. For example, are you sure he's the Messiah? Are you absolutely sure? Are you going to stake your life on this man being the Messiah? He doesn't look like the Messiah. I'll tell you what, you want to be sure? When Pilate asks who you want to release, do I release Jesus or do I release Barabbas? Call for Barabbas, because if he's truly the Messiah, he can't be killed. If he's truly the Messiah, the Romans can't hurt him. So therefore, it will prove, it'll force his hand to show if he's the Messiah. And I think they were successful in cleverly stirring up the crowd to release Barabbas. See, here is Pilate, this governor clothed with brief authority. He's no match for the demonic agents and these envious men and their hypocrisy and the evil. And the crowd, of course, they're caught in the middle. Listen, how many people are quite unaware of what's going on when it comes to even who Jesus is, what the Bible even says? And, you know, simple people have no clue about these things. They're swayed by the continual barrage of the deception. These specials about Jesus that they craftily find some joker who is not really an honest scholar in regard to taking the full account of the Scriptures, and they subtly put in those objections, and they show, well, if all the intelligent people don't believe that Jesus is the Son of God, and you'd have to be, it's almost like the snob appeal, you know, you can't really be an intelligent person and believe the Bible, can you? And, you know, the intimidation factor is very powerful. And so this crowd was stirred up. Now, envy is really the motive. Envy is an ugly thing. Don't underestimate the power of envy, the damage it can do. You know, when you think about it, Pilate had been deeply impressed by Jesus himself, apparently. His wife had told him, don't have anything to do with this man, in a dream, according to the other gospel account. And Pilate knew something was wrong here. He knew this man was no threat to Rome. He knew it was all envy. Envy is a very base, ugly thing that really comes out of, if you think about what envy is, it comes out of a deep insecurity. If you're envious of something that someone else has, it's because you're not content with what you have. You're a little unsure of yourself. Why haven't you been dealt that card? Why aren't they recognizing your greatness? Why aren't these people acknowledging you and giving you that job opportunity so you can make a lot of money? And look, what's so special about him? And this is the spirit of insecurity. Here's what happens, however, when you become a true believer. Something dramatically changes. See, that was me before. Even when I was successful in wrestling, it wasn't enough just to beat my opponent. I had to beat him into the ground. And then when I was interviewed afterwards, I had to say, oh, give me a challenge. I was very arrogant, very proud. But it wasn't enough. I needed everyone to think I was great. So that's all my focus was. Because I was insecure. It's insecurity. See, when you look at people that are very good at what they do, and yet they acknowledge others and what they've done, and they don't point the attention to themselves, they're secure. They don't have to be the center of attention. I needed to be the center of attention. I was very insecure. I had a lot of deep insecurities from my upbringing, not having a dad, and you know, I'm always trying to prove to the world, lost my mom and my grandmother raising us. So I had to prove to everybody, I'm in charge here. I know what I'm doing. And you know, young people that don't have that security in family often have great insecurities later on. But here's the interesting thing. When the Lord got a hold of my heart, I was enveloped in love of such a nature that it no longer mattered to me what people thought of me. I was accepted by God. I was filled. And all I could do was just, it was spilling out on others. Just kindness toward others and patience and acceptance of others and encouraging others. Now I could build others up. If I saw they were more talented in an area, I'd say, you know what, you've got a much better gift at that than me. Why don't you do this? And I found a way of just, it was always lifting people up instead of tearing people down. Why? Because love is in my heart now. I was transformed from the inside. See, but envy is a sign. Look, Satan himself was found with iniquity, though created perfect. Lucifer. Something changed in him, and he wanted to be like God. He was envious. And so he rebelled. When you think of Cain, why did he slay his brother Abel? Why did he kill his brother Abel? The Bible tells us. Because his deeds were evil and his brothers were righteous. He was envious. Why is he accepted and not me? Why did Joseph's brothers betray Joseph and sell him as a slave? They were envious of him. He was the father's favorite. Look, you could go on through all of history and see the damage that envy has done. Church splits, oftentimes. People longing for power, and perceiving, you know, they can have more power, and they get their little disciples after themselves. And it's envy. Envy is a very deadly thing. So here the chief priests are working the crowd. Pilate is essentially caught in a tough spot here. So he has to go to another solution here. And of course, the solution he's going to come up with is quite sad. But notice verse 12 through 14. It says, Pilate answered them again and said, "What then do you want me to do with him who is called King of the Jews?" And that is the question. What shall I do with Jesus? What shall I do with this man? And they cried out again, "Crucify him." I mean, it was one thing to ask for Barabbas. It's quite another thing to force Pilate to crucify him. Because again, I think the only explanation is they're thinking if they force him, it'll force Messiah, if he is the Messiah, to show his hand. Well, Pilate said to them, "Why? What evil has he done?" But they cried out all the more, "Crucify him. There is no reason." I know a lot of people that put what I would call a fleece out. Testing. Kind of like, if you're really there, God, then make this happen. And when it doesn't happen the way they think it should, they basically say there is no God. I like the one young man who was in Hyde Park there in England where they'd have speakers, you know, corner, and they'd get up on the little soapbox and they'd start giving their speeches, and anyone can speak on anything. And one young man got up and began speaking about the things of God. And of course, there's hecklers and mockers there. You have to endure with a lot of stuff on that, whatever you speak on. And the whole subject came around to mocking this young man for his belief in God. And why do you think that there is a God? And the question came to him. You know, this man said, "Look, if there is a God, then I demand right now, if there is a God, that he'd strike me dead. Right now, in 5 seconds, strike me dead if there's a God. Easy." So nothing happened. And he says, "See, there is no God. If there's a God, if I were God, I would have struck me. I would have proved that I'm there. Why wouldn't God?" And the young man simply replied, he says, "God is just proving how merciful and patient he is. He's not proving that he's not there." See, so many times we set up the conditions in our own minds. What we think will prove to me that there is a God, that the Bible is real. And if God doesn't march to our instructions, we discount it. But unfortunately, see, we're failing the real test. What shall I do with Jesus? So the innocent solution didn't work, Pilate appearing to speak for Jesus. The Herod solution didn't work. The Barabbas solution now, appealing to the crowd, has not worked. So now he's got one other possibility. I call it the scourging solution. Pilate, wanting to gratify the crowd, released Barabbas to them and he delivered Jesus after he had scourged him. Now John tells us that he scourged him, and it, oftentimes the scourging process was used to get a confession. In other words, it's a horrible thing. As they would spread your back out around a pole and tighten it up, they would take this whip, tying it with little pieces of lead and glass and hooks, and literally just rake that thing over your spread out, stretched out back, and it would rip the flesh off your back 40 times. Well, they would often mercifully do 39. It wouldn't go to the 40th. But after 39 times of that, your back would look like raw hamburger. It was a horrible way. And when they brought Jesus out, according to John, after he was scourged, there he is standing there, and Pilate, still appealing, says, "Behold the man," which a lot of people have read a lot of things into that. But essentially, there's almost a picture of pity. Do you want me to do anything more with him than this? What does he deserve? But ultimately, they cried out, "Crucify him." And Mark basically says, after he had scourged him, they delivered him to be crucified. Pilate, one day he's going to lose his job. And according to historians, he ends up taking his life in the end. It does not end well for him. Listen, how it ends for you, it's largely going to be determined on what you do with Jesus. What will you do with him who is called the Son of God, the King of the Jews? The soldiers now, he's turned over to them. Verse 16, notice, the soldiers led him away to the hall called Praetorium, and they called together the whole garrison. We were just at there in this place in the Antonio Fortress, the Roman pavement. They've got the little scribbles there where the Roman soldiers played their games, and most likely this was the place. Well, it says they clothed him with purple, they twisted a crown of thorns and put it on his head, began to salute him mockingly, of course, "Hail, King of the Jews." They struck him on the head and with a reed and spat at him, and bowing the knee, they worshipped him. And when they had mocked him, they took the purple off of him, put on his own clothes, and led him out to crucify him. Now, if you're one of those soldiers, you're just doing your job. It's just my job. You know, I'm amazed at how many times people hide under the guise of, well, you know, I'm just doing what's expected of me. You know in your heart, your conscience is just bothering you about something that your job is requiring you to do, even though it's not right. Just doing my job. And in this case, the soldiers even do it with a little more relish. But how we have this account most likely is one of these soldiers somewhere along the line came to acknowledge Jesus as Lord and eventually gave this account to one of the gospel writers. But here he is, scourged and mocked. And the physical effects of the scourging and the treatment, you know, listen, I know people go into a lot of detail on this. I know the Passion of the Christ. And again, I think it takes it to a level where it almost elicits sympathy for him, when I don't believe that's the real point. He was, by his stripes, the Bible says, we are healed. These wounds that he received were for our benefit. He is conquering here. They're the ones that are on trial. Just as we are on trial, hearing these words, what shall we do with these things? And then we come to the last character that really is an amazing, interesting guy. We don't know a whole lot about him except that he was kind of in the wrong place at the wrong time or the right place at the right time, depending on how you look at it. Verse 21, it says, they compelled a certain man, Simon a Cyrenian. Cyrene was a place in northern Africa. Some have speculated that he was African descent, but there was a large Jewish population there, so we really don't know. He was the father of Alexander and Rufus, and he was coming out of the country and passing by, they compelled him to bear his cross. So he just happened to be at the right place at the right time. Hey, you, come over here. Grab this guy's cross. Now, Jesus, of course, was a lot weaker than an average criminal being led to be crucified. And one of the reasons is because, remember, he had that night of prayer in which he was sweating great drops of blood, emotionally drained. has he made his mind up as a man to endure all of this. Then, of course, he was arrested, taken before Caiaphas. First Annas, then Caiaphas. Had a trial all night. And then the temple guards beat him and slapped him around and hit him and mocked him. And then in the morning he's dragged. Remember, no sleep. He's dragged before Pilate. And he goes through this whole thing. Then the scourging process. So he's greatly weakened. They would normally put the cross beam on top of them. They'd strap the cross beam. They'd have to carry that cross beam. And then when they'd do is they'd set them on that. They'd put it on the other part. They'd affix them to it with the nails. And then they would put the post in the ground. And there he would be there crucified. Well, on the way, of course, apparently he was too weak in his condition to carry the cross. The soldiers then just happened to see this guy who just happens to be coming from the country, just happens to be right there, bang, grabbed him. What I find interesting is that it seems so arbitrary. No hint is given as to why they chose him. And it seems arbitrary, just happened to be there, unlucky guy, too bad for you. Couldn't argue, Roman soldiers tell you to do something. But interestingly enough, you see, Mark tells us he was the father of Alexander and Rufus. Now, how would Mark know that? Other than the fact that most likely, of course, we know Rufus later is written about in Romans 16. Paul writes and says, "Greet Rufus, chosen in the Lord." Chosen in the Lord. And his mother and mine. So apparently his father had died by that point. But in the meantime, something about Simon. Obviously, he became a believer in Jesus down the road, led his children, Alexander and Rufus, to the faith. They're followers of the Lord, and Paul calls Rufus chosen in the Lord. Now, wait a minute. This just seems so arbitrary. Let me tell you something. Young people going to college, you might hear some very clever professor try to sell this to you. This is how it's going to sound. And I don't know if I even brought this up in a partial way before, but I want you to think this through with me. You get into college and your professor basically says, look, everything your parents taught you is all junk. Everything you've learned before at church or in any other place is all junk. I'm going to teach you how to think. And of course, he's going to attack your Christianity. He's going to attack in this way. He's going to say, the only reason you're a Christian is because you were in the proximity of Christian teaching. You were able to hear Christian teaching. Maybe your parents raised you. Maybe some youth leader had an influence on you. But he said, if you were not here, if you were born in some other country like India or China, or Iran, you'd be either a Muslim, or you'd be a Hindu, or you'd be a Buddhist. You just happen to be born here, very arbitrarily, that's why you're a Christian. There's nothing special about Jesus. You just happen to be a Christian because that's how you were raised. That's what you've been influenced. Now, it sounds pretty clever. It sounds pretty like, well, yeah, how do you answer that? Well, there's nothing arbitrary about it. Listen, there's nothing arbitrary about where you're born. There's nothing arbitrary about being formed in the womb. There's nothing arbitrary about being chosen by God. Go back to Abraham. Abraham was called and his descendants to be a blessing to the whole world. They were chosen. There was nothing special about them except God chose them for the purpose of being a witness to the world of how great God is. So if you were born in a Jewish family, you would have been learning the Torah. But it wasn't arbitrary. It was God's purpose on you from the time before you were born. He purposed where you'd be born, under what family you'd be born, the influences that you've had, so that you then could take those things, that privilege, the light you've received, and be a blessing to places that have not had the opportunity, because that's how God works. There's nothing arbitrary. So you can say to the professor, well, it might seem arbitrary to you of where I am born and what family I'm in, but it's not arbitrary at all to God because he chose me before the foundation of the world existed. He knew me long before I was even born. And so it might seem arbitrary to Simon that he just happened to be there at the right time, but it wasn't. God just picked him out. Now think about if you're Simon, this is the most uncomfortable day of your life. This is the most unbelievably bad luck day you've ever had. I mean, talking about bad days. I'm sure he went back to his wife that night and says, what a bad day I had. You have no idea. And yet, that bad day turned out to be pretty good in the end. You know, I think so often we... Listen, I don't even know what kind of drama went on in your life even to come to church today. But I suspect, knowing human nature, that some of you had a real difficult go of it. It wasn't an easy thing to get here. And you didn't even know the spiritual battle going on. You were oblivious to all of the things behind the scenes and the spiritual nature of even getting here to hear the words of God, to have a greater purpose of God. And then you don't even know, too, the weeks that you miss, what you're missing. And some of the pieces of the puzzle that now you're trying to deal with issues and not have the scriptures in you, not have the wisdom of God to fight this spiritual battle. Listen, we might think of the bad things that have happened to us. And listen, loss of loved ones, health issues, horrible news, maybe a loss of a child. There are a lot of painful things that none of us wish happened to us. But as we're in this world, we have to understand this. God is above all those things. And even through those painful things that we experience, God is authoring something different in us. It's not arbitrary at all. Pilate had an opportunity to be a great man. And he chose the easy road. The Pharisees and the leaders had opportunities to be there to welcome the Messiah as he came. Instead, they were thinking of themselves. The crowd... The average crowd, the mob, clueless, just going along with the flow. The soldiers just doing their job. Simon the Cyrenian just happened to be there at the wrong time, yet it was the right time. And I want to submit to you, it's the right time. See, there is no wrong time with God. God is the author of all of these things, allowing His own Son here. There is no luck, there's no chance, there's no accident. Those are mere words we use to describe things we don't understand. Ask Simon the Cyrene now what he thinks, if you could interview him. Ask Pilate. I wish we could interview Pilate. I wish we could bring him back and say, let's say, what do you say, Gov? Think you made a good decision? You know, it's amazing how we don't consider how it will all end. Decisions we make. There's a lot of painful decisions in marriage and life and in living, to do the right thing, denying yourself, thinking of others. Painful decisions. Loss here and there. You just have to suck it up and go forward. It's not easy. But when you see the end result of trusting the Lord with your life, well, the proof's in the pudding, in the end. But you see, right now we don't see the end. We're on page 67 of this horrific adventure, and it's really painful. But I want to challenge you. You see, God is on the throne. All of these things were purposed by the Lord. Just the way that He throws in Alexander and Rufus, who was the children of this man, Simon, because it was purposeful that God would bring him into that place. How God works.